it's the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour on 810 WGY.
I'm Greg Rinke, and each Sunday at 9 p.m., I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Tully, to give our insight on the legal and political issues happening locally and across the country that affect you. In addition to listening on your radio, we're broadcasting around the world on www.wgy.com. Visit our show site at www.tullyrinkeshow.com for podcasts of previous shows and to comment on our blog. In honor of the July 4th holiday this past Friday, we're going to explore the laws surrounding warfare tonight. The way that war is fought today is very different from how it was fought in 1776 during the American Revolution. Not only will we explain the origins of the rules of the battlefield, but also how they've changed in the face of terrorism. We'll also look at the treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay and the debate over what is considered torture. And finally, we'll explain how military courts differ from the civilian justice system. Joining us each week are Valerie and Chris, our on-air correspondents. In the producer's booth is Greg and our favorite intern, Taylor. Let's begin from where the laws of war started from. The idea that the certain fixed laws should apply even amid violence and war isn't new. There's a saying that all's fair in war, but in reality there have always been restrictions on the battlefield. And those restrictions on the battlefield have basically come from way back when, with the Hebrew Bible forbidding soldiers from, among other things, destroying fruit-bearing trees in hostile lands, and there being such codes existing in the Middle Ages. The American law of war can be traced to the 1860s when Lieber's Code was introduced that prohibited soldiers from certain acts of violence against the wounded. In 1864, the 12 European nations met in Geneva, Switzerland, and devised the rules for treating the sick and the wounded, and the resulting convention, which became known as the Geneva Convention, for the amelioration of the condition of the wounded armies in the field, which was signed in 1864.
You know, Greg, a lot of our listeners don't know, but you're actually a former Judge Advocate General?
That's right. I served in the Army JAG Corps for 6 years, from 1999 to 2004. And one of the areas of education was the rules of war, and it's very much drummed into young judge advocates that there are certain rules and conditions that apply to the law of war.
And I've known you for almost 20 years, and you're also a little bit of a military historian.
That's right. The history of warfare and the history of the law of war is a very interesting subject and has changed dramatically. For instance, during the American Revolution, the British thought it was very dishonorable the way that our forefathers fought the war, and that we would no longer line up and shoot at each other from within 300 yards. And the American patriots would basically hide behind trees and rocks, and some people thought that that was no longer fighting in an honorable manner.
Well, how's an IED any different?
Well, I mean, an IED, I think when you're setting up an IED, there's no way that you can determine who's going to set off that IED. I mean, an IED can be set off by a civilian truck, can be set off by a military truck. At least that the way that the American Revolution was fought, we were still fighting on a battlefield, still aiming at the enemy, still being able to be shot at. I think using IEDs, I mean, on a battlefield situation, I think that it's probably permissible. However, when you're putting it on a civilian road where you have civilian cars and you have women and children driving, I find that to be despicable. And quite honestly, it's in violation of the Geneva Convention.
So what's going to happen to those Iraqi farmers that are taking $100 from Al-Qaeda to implant an IED? Are they going to get prosecuted in The Hague?
No. They're not going to be prosecuted in The Hague. They're not going to be prosecuted by an international criminal court. I think what would happen is if they're rounded up, I think that they're going to be held as enemy combatants by the American military, or they'd be turned over to Iraqi control, and I think the Iraqi justice system would deal with them.
Is Iraq a member of the Geneva Convention?
Yes.
When they had the change from Saddam Hussein to a democratic government, did that invalidate all the prior treaties that Iraq had?
I don't believe it does. I believe that they're signatory to the Geneva Convention, that Geneva Convention still holds. However, you know, it really doesn't apply now because the war is over in Iraq in regard to us having invaded an Iraqi nation. Now what we're dealing with is really a civil war, and that's also covered in the Geneva Convention under Convention 3, which is deals with civil war. So it's still covered, but it's no longer one nation against another nation. It's more now of a civil war.
You know, one of the questions I always had as a former paratrooper, could you shoot under the Geneva Convention a paratrooper coming out of an airplane if you were an enemy?
Well, that's actually a good question, and there's some debate as to whether or not you can shoot paratroopers until they land on the ground. It has been interpreted, at least when I went through the JAG school, that if those paratroopers are shooting down at you, absolutely, you can shoot up at them. If they're coming down and they're in a position of vulnerability where they're not even having their weapon out, it would be impermissible to shoot paratroopers or shoot for their actual parachutes to kill them.
Recently, Israel and Hezbollah and the Lebanese were involved in a conflict in which they were shooting artillery pieces and missiles out of the center of towns. Mm-hmm. Is that a permissible, not the Israelis, but the opponents, is that a permissible use of artillery and rockets?
Absolutely not. And that's one of the big issues that we see. And it's in unconventional warfare, we see nations or Hezbollah moving artillery pieces into hospitals, into churches, American Red Cross buildings, because they know that another signatory to the Geneva Convention cannot hit those targets. Those are civilian targets. But the argument becomes, if they're using those places and they're putting in artillery pieces and they're shooting at your people, killing your people, can you return fire? And the answer is it has to be proportional. Proportionality basically means you need to use an amount of force that is going to end the threat and not kill unnecessary civilians. So the case of if you put an artillery piece in a hospital, and depending on the size of the hospital, if there's one or two patients in that hospital and you have multiple artillery pieces around that hospital, you're going to be able to knock out that hospital, and it's not going to be a violation of the Geneva Convention. But that being said, is if there's one artillery piece and there's 10,000 patients laying around that hospital, to knock out that artillery piece is not going to be proportional and would be precluded by the Geneva Convention.
So if the Taliban and Iraqi insurgents get to use IEDs and Hezbollah gets to use, you know, rockets from the middle of a hospital, why should we comply with the Geneva Convention if all of our enemies and the enemies of our friends are not?
Well, that's always been the problem, Matt, with the Geneva Convention, is it always seems like the United States is complying with the terms of the Geneva Convention and our enemies are not. I mean, during World War II, it was commonplace where the Germans or the Japanese would take prisoners and shoot them at point-blank range. I mean, after the Battle of the Bulge, they basically slaughtered 250 of our 82nd Airborne troops that were surrendering after the Battle of the Bulge, lined them up, backed up some trucks where there were machine guns, and machine gunned them down. Absolutely, it's disgusting. And what is the reason that we comply with it? Well, we hope that by complying it with the Geneva Conventions that we're protecting our soldiers on the battlefield so that if they do fall into enemy hands, that they will be protected and that the enemy will comply with the Geneva Conventions. And also, we like to think that we make war only on armed individuals. And once they lay down their arms, once they're wounded, the point of inflicting casualties has ceased.
You know, one of the things that I found interesting when I was in Iraq is the number of Red Cross personnel that were there. They were actually co-located in our division headquarters. What exactly is the role of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent in war zones?
Well, the American Red Cross is basically tasked with the ability to go into prisoner of war camps to make sure that prisoners of war are being treated humanely, that they're receiving their mail, that they're receiving food. The problem with that always is when the American Red Cross goes in, the nation holding the prisoners clean up the prisoner of war camps. Nazi Germany did this during World War II routinely, would clean up the camps and would basically make everything look like it was a great, happy place to be. And as soon as the American Red Cross left, things would go back to normal, where they'd be withholding rations and treating their prisoners pretty harshly.
Aren't we doing something similar to that in Guantanamo Bay? Didn't we limit the Red Cross's ability to wander around?
That there have been those accusations. Matt, I need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll continue with our discussion on the laws of war and how they've changed since September 11th.
As a busy working professional, looking good's important to you. No one understands this better than Best Cleaners, the Capital Region's premier garment care provider and dry cleaner. Got a wrinkle in your schedule? Best Cleaners offers pickup and delivery of your dry cleaning right from your home or office, so you don't have to fit one more errand into your busy week. Call 458-BEST, and we'll take care of the rest. With three locations in Del Mar, Loudonville, and on the Latham Circle, Best Cleaners. Always look your best. Call 458-BEST. 458-BEST.
If a commercial lease is in your future, listen closely. Conley Associates will provide you with an honest, unbiased comparison of available office space. Unlike the competition, Conley Associates works directly with you, the tenant, finding your business the ideal location at the best terms. Best of all, leave the landlords to us, because we represent tenants only. Secure your new office space with a tenants-only approach from Conley Associates. Landlords need not apply. Conley Associates, 463-5500.
You know this isn't the right job for you, but the problem is you don't know what the right job is. If you're looking for career advice, Careers in Transition LLC can help. Careers in Transition LLC is a career counseling firm that helps you figure out the right job for you. They're not an employment agency, and Dr. Tom Denham is not a headhunter, but they can help you write a better resume, prep for a job interview, and a lot more. Careers in Transition LLC, 11 Computer Drive West in Albany, 366-8451, and online, Careers in Transition LLC.com.
You've worked hard to acquire your wealth. Let us help you keep it. Hi, I'm Abigail Doolittle, Portfolio Manager at Johnson Illington Advisors. Johnson Illington is a money management firm that provides very conservative and disciplined portfolio management services. Our main goal at Johnson Illington is to preserve and enhance your wealth. We have a highly experienced team led by nationally known investment veteran and economist Hugh Johnson. Visit our website at johnson-illington.com. Johnson Illington Advisors on Broadway in Albany.
Welcome back to the Tully Legal Power Hour. I'm Greg Rinke, and with me is my co-host, Matthew Tully. Tonight we're talking about the laws of war. Warfare has changed in the wake of September 11th, and it's highly debated whether or not random acts of terrorism should be included under the Geneva Conventions. Chris, what do you think about this?
Well, actually, I got a couple questions for you. After the Geneva Convention, terrorism, is that covered under that? So are terrorists covered under the Geneva Convention?
Well, I mean, that's a good point. And I think that gets to the heart of the matter is what happened on September 11th is we had an Al-Qaeda cells basically making war or conducting terrorism acts against the United States and not attacking military targets.
Pentagon's not a military target?
That's what I was about to say, is arguably that the Pentagon was a military target and would have been a permissible target if there had been a declared war. However, in this case, there was no declared war. And also they hit targets, civilian targets. Clearly the Twin Towers were civilian targets with thousands of civilians, with children, was not a military target. So should the Geneva Conventions apply to Al-Qaeda? Well, there's a couple of provisions that you need to first look at. In order for the Geneva Conventions to apply and for terrorists to be afforded prisoner of war status, they need to carry arms openly, which means that you can't be running around with, you know, machine guns and pistols down your pants or down your shirt, and you need to be in a uniform. And Al-Qaeda does not qualify under those provisions.
Well, I guess my next question is, President Bush said that we're fighting a war on terror. That doesn't seem right to me, because isn't it saying in the Geneva Convention that war has to be fought between two states? There's no terrorism. They're not part of a state. How can you say that?
That goes to part of the problem with the Geneva Conventions is does the Geneva Conventions apply to civil wars? Well, I think that's pretty clear. It does apply to civil wars. But how does it apply to warfare of the 21st century? You know, looking at the Geneva Conventions were adapted really to prevent things, the atrocities that happened in big wars, major wars like World War I, where Germany and England and France were using poison gas, chlorine, and horrible battlefield disfigurements, blindings.
And IEDs don't do the same thing?
They do. However, the problem with that is that these are not open armies that are fighting on an open battlefield. These are hit-and-miss type things. These are terrorist attacks. These are not – they're not on an open battlefield. There's been no declared war. So basically, does the Geneva Conventions even apply to these type of conflicts? Arguably, they do not apply. Al-Qaeda, what country is Al-Qaeda from? Al-Qaeda is from a hodgepodge of countries. So the Geneva Conventions probably do not apply.
So it's more of a fight on war. It's not a fight on terror. It's not really a war on terror?
Well, I think President Bush used the word war on terror to express that we were going to fight terror and we were going to go to war with terror. I don't think it was a war on terror in such that we declared war. Congress has never formally declared war on terror. So there is a distinction there.
And I think it's important to point out that President Bush hasn't used the global war on terrorism phrase in a few years. It's 2008 now. The last time I heard George Bush say that was 2005, 2006.
Well, the real question, though, is after the September 11th attacks, does it require us to get stronger? Does it require us to maybe do away with some of the protections that would be protected under the Geneva Convention? And Val, what is your position in regard to whether or not after 9/11 we need to get tougher on terrorism and terrorists?
I believe, considering that the attack was unjust and we were blinded by it, we should act a little tougher. They're fighting dirty, so why can't we fight them back dirty?
Well, I think that's an interesting point is how do we get the information out from the terrorists? I mean, if they're conducting and committing all these heinous acts, how do we get information out of them without, resorting to arguably torture?
Well, what's military tribunals? Isn't that the purpose of a military tribunal, is to extract information while also ensuring that the prisoners are given adequate legal protection?
I would argue no. The military tribunals are to seek justice. They're not to seek information. Military tribunals are basically set up where you have a military judge appointed to a case, and then you have the enemy combatants are going to be represented either by private civilian counsel, or in a lot of cases they're going to be appointed counsel from the military that's holding them. So in our case, their defense counsel are actually Army officers, Army Defense Counsel, which a lot of these people that have been accused have problems with is, hey, you're putting me before a judge who's an American Army officer, the prosecutor is an American Army officer, and my defense counsel is an American Army officer. And so there is a problem with that.
But you used to be a trial defense counsel. Isn't it not true the trial defense counsel have a completely separate chain of command than the prosecutors and
that
the
is
judges?
True. Many years ago, there were problems where trial defense service lawyers in the Army or in the armed forces, if they started to do such a good job in getting soldiers off or getting soldiers acquitted, all of a sudden they found themselves being transferred from being a defense counsel to being back to a prosecutor. So probably about 10 years ago, the Army and all the other branches has basically centralized their trial defense services, so they no longer fall under the chain of command, so there's not unlawful command influence. But still, I mean, let's face it, if you're picked up in a foreign nation and you're being prosecuted by that nation, and that nation is also giving you an Army officer to represent you, Matt, you wouldn't have a problem with that? Wouldn't you think that they were in cahoots?
Oh, I definitely have a problem with it, but that's my own personal opinion. What we're doing in Guantanamo Bay is not the best practice of the American military. You mentioned enemy combatants. What's the difference between enemy combatants versus prisoners of war versus detainees? The media seems to use all three words interchangeably.
Well, that's a big subject of debate. In order to qualify for prisoner of war status under the Geneva Conventions, you need to carry arms openly. You need to wear a uniform, and it needs to be during a declared period of hostility. We don't have that with al-Qaeda, so clearly they are not POWs. What have we been calling them? We've been calling them enemy combatants. We've been calling them detainees.
What does all that mean, Greg? What is an enemy combatant or a detainee compared to a POW?
What is an enemy combatant is kind of subject to debate. No one really knows what it is. It's the term that's kind of been used by President Bush, by the Bush administration, by the prosecutors. But what is a detainee? Well, a detainee could be someone that is following the American Army or any army and gets captured. It could be someone that is selling goods, a contractor, could be afforded detainee status. A detainee is entitled to certain protections. And that's the problem, I think, that a lot of people have with Guantanamo Bay. We're going on to, 2009, we're going on 8 years now where these detainees have been held and they really have not had their day in court. I mean, I think that's an extremely long time to hold someone And under the Geneva Conventions, or even not under the Geneva Conventions, even under detainee status, they have the right, I think, to challenge why they're being held.
You know, if you're a lawyer, you find this aspect of law very interesting because this is brand new. The Supreme Court is making brand new case law, and a lot of the things that you're saying are hotly contested amongst lawyers. Can you explain why this is interesting and how habeas corpus is applicable here?
I think it's extremely interesting, especially because of the special status of Guantanamo Bay. Guantanamo Bay was basically given to us, or leased to us, I should say, after the Spanish-American War. After we won that war, we had the right to lease the Guantanamo Bay for a period of time, which has not ever been subject to termination. So the question really was, is what is the special status of Guantanamo Bay? And there's a reason that the detainees are at Guantanamo Bay, because no one really knew of what Guantanamo Bay, what the legal jurisdiction of it was.
And what did the Supreme Court say?
Well, the Supreme Court came down a couple weeks ago and made it very clear that those people being held at Guantanamo Bay are subject to habeas corpus. And what does habeas corpus mean? It's a legal term, which means to produce the body, which means they have the right to challenge why they're being held in federal court. And previously, that has not been held. They have been denied the right to petition why they're being held. I think it's a good decision. I think it's a decision that makes sense that they should have the right to petition why they're being held, especially in a case like this that has dragged on for 8 years. I think what's going to be interesting is after the next president is elected, I predict that Guantanamo Bay will probably be shut down and these people being held will be tried in federal courts or military tribunals in the United States.
Well, I think that's what both McCain and Obama are saying, is that Gitmo is going to close.
I think it has to. I think in order to maintain the legitimacy of what we're doing by holding these alleged terrorists, we have to give them due process. They have to have due process to challenge why they're being held. And, you know, 8 years is very much outrageous that we can't put together some sort of tribunal to try these individuals and give them the right.
But they've had tribunals, and the Supreme Court has held the first set of tribunals was unconstitutional. Right. So then the Congress and the president created another set of tribunals, which the Supreme Court is debating right now whether or not to hear the case as to whether or not the second set of tribunals are lawful.
Right. Well, the reason that those other tribunals have been held to be unlawful is they were very restrictive. I mean, way too restrictive, in such that those people being held were not even able to see the evidence that was being held against them. Their lawyers were not able to see the evidence being held against them. At one point, they wanted to tape record any conversations that defense lawyers were having with their clients. I mean, these are just outrageous rules, and that's the reason that it was held to be unconstitutional or not legal.
Well, Greg, as you know, I'm in the National Guard. If I got orders to Guantanamo Bay, it sounds like what they're doing down there, you know, could be declared unlawful at some time in the future. Can I refuse to go to Guantanamo Bay if my National Guard unit gets ordered down there because I think what they're doing is unlawful?
I don't believe so. I believe it's a lawful order to order you down there, and I believe once you're down there, if you're having a problem or you see something that is what you believe to be unlawful, you bring it to your chain of command. There's been some prosecutors and defense attorneys who have been assigned to Guantanamo Bay who have resigned or basically turned down assignments because they feel that ethically they cannot participate in these type of proceedings. So I think that would be the correct route as to just refusing to go. When we're back from the news and weather, we'll look at the interrogation techniques used today and discuss what is considered torture.
Fox News Radio, I'm Don Matheson. In California, over 300 wildfires continue to threaten homes and businesses. A dry spell and a heat wave are hampering firefighting efforts.
Much of Central California, the Interior Valley this year, saw the lowest amount of rainfall on record. You take the low rain, then you take high temperatures, making it much easier to burn.
Fox meteorologist Rick Reichmuth. Christie Brinkley and Peter Cook's divorce trial resumes tomorrow. The focus, Who gets the kids?
The former supermodel wants sole custody of the couple's 10-year-old daughter and Brinkley's 13-year-old son, who Cook adopted when they were married. Last week, Brinkley laid out the painful details of finding out about her husband's affair with an 18-year-old girl, supporting him while he played around, and about his appetite for internet porn sites.
Fox's Laura Ingle: Brinkley expected to be put on the hot seat when her husband's lawyer tries to turn the table. AAA says gas prices near $4.11 a gallon, a record. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Not many weather problems tonight. There's only an isolated chance of seeing a thunder shower through the rest of the nighttime hours. Outside of that, we're dry and mild at 68. Monday will be partly cloudy, though. Scattered thunder showers, highs of 87. Tuesday, that front's out of here. We're back to dry weather. We're partly cloudy, and here comes the heat again. We'll see our temperatures near 90. From the Weather Channel, I'm Terry Smith with the 810 WGY Storm Team Forecast.
Pets aren't just animals. They're companions and often members of the family. Unfortunately, pets are not always treated with the care they deserve. Animal cruelty and neglect are sadly a reality. Detecting and reporting abuse are the most important steps in bringing animal cruelty to an end. The Schenectady County Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, SPCA, is a nonprofit volunteer organization that investigates complaints of animal cruelty. Our volunteers donate their time and energy because they believe in our mission to protect animals. We are not funded. We rely exclusively on public donations. You can help with a tax-deductible donation by calling 518-755-9517 or visit our website, schenectadyspca.org. Or, if you'd like to join the Schenectady SPCA as a volunteer, again the number 518-755-9517 or on the web, schenectadyspca.org.
All right, Integral One Network Solutions. Tell me what they do again.
Well, they worked with us to design our new computer network. That's really made a difference. Helps us run our business better. They monitor everything 24/7 to keep it running smoothly. And they manage it all, so I don't have to hire an IT guy.
So when I hire Integral One, they manage my network so I can manage my business. Talk about peace of mind.
Integral One Network Solutions. Online at integralone.net. That's integralone.net. 464-4014.
Thanks for coming back to us. If you're a first-time listener, you're listening to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Greg Rinke, and each Sunday at 9 p.m., my co-host, Matt Tully, and I let you know about the legal issues going on around the capital region and the world. We're broadcasting around the planet on www.wgy.com. Tonight we're discussing the rules of war. The court system for military personnel may be similar to the civilian one, but there are some large differences in how the process works and what soldiers can be prosecuted for. And we're going to get into that in a little bit. First, we want to turn to what is considered torture. That is something that has been brought up by Matt Tully in the last segment. And I do want to read exactly what is the definition of torture, because I think it's important to have an understanding as to what is torture before we can actually discuss what constitutes torturous acts and which acts are permitted under the Geneva Convention. According to the Convention, torture is any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or a confession, or punishing him for an act he or a third person has committed or is suspected to have committed, or intimidating or coercing him or a third person for any reason based on discrimination of any kind.
That seems very restrictive, Greg. How are you supposed to get information out from people that really don't want to give it to you when it could be very important information?
Well, I think that becomes part of the problem, and especially with how war has changed and how terrorist acts have changed after 9/11. I mean, there are a lot of people that believe and feel out there that if we capture a terrorist, if it's going to prevent another 9/11, it's completely permissible to torture that person. Val, what's your feeling on that?
Personally, I believe in security of a country and its individuals over that of individual human rights. If you're going to get information that can prevent deaths from occurring, I don't really see why, what kind of choice you have than to do that.
So you really kind of believe that if the end justifies the means,
greater
you're good to go.
For the greater good.
Good. But where do we draw the line on torture? I mean, there's various levels of torture, and one of them is waterboarding, which has been in the news. And
what's waterboarding?
Waterboarding is basically suffocation via water, pouring water in your mouth with blindfold on and
Well, let's set the picture here. Waterboarding, they basically put you on a board. They tilt it so that your toes are about 2 to 3 feet over your head. So you're laid down with your head on the ground. They have you with a mask on, and they pour water into your nose and mouth to the point where you're about to pass out, and then they stop.
That's correct.
That's what waterboarding is.
Yep.
And that seems to meet the definition of torture.
Oh, it clearly does meet the definition.
But President Bush says it doesn't.
He says it does not because it does not leave any long-lasting problems.
I mean, where does long-lasting problems come into your definition there under the Geneva Convention?
It doesn't. And, you know, that's where the question becomes. I mean, with waterboarding, if you're going to get information out of a terrorist who's been captured, and this is actually the case, I mean, one of the...
A terrorist or any member... Any enemy combatant or detainee?
I think that we have to draw a line there. I think if it's an armed conflict and we've captured a POW, absolutely, it should not be committed on them. Torturous acts should not be committed. Waterboarding should not be committed on them. However, if they're non POW status, they're not carrying arms openly, they're not fighting fair. Why should we have to fight fair?
Because we're better than them.
Well, I mean, that's part of the argument. But if we're able to prevent another 9/11 by waterboarding someone, there's not going to be any long-lasting effects of that waterboarding. Why not? Why can't we waterboard them, especially if it's going to make them talk? And from what I understand, one of the Al-Qaeda members who was captured in, I believe it was Pakistan, as soon as he was waterboarded, he started squealing like a little pig. I mean, and he divulged a lot of useful information because he did not want to be waterboarded. And, you know, he's not a POW. He doesn't have POW status. I honestly don't see a problem why we can't waterboard someone like that.
Well, here's my take on it. As somebody who served in combat, I try and picture myself being taken prisoner. And I wouldn't do anything to somebody else that I wouldn't want done to me.
But
and I know
right
I wouldn't want the insurgents to slice my throat off, you know, like they did to... somebody that took prisoner, nor would I want to be waterboarded.
But right
because
there,
I have a low pain tolerance. I'd probably squeal like a little pig if somebody did that to me, too.
Isn't that the point, though? Isn't that what we want?
And I think
low
there's
pain tolerance right there, then you're done.
Well, there's then why absolute, are we in the Geneva Convention?
There's an absolute difference, too. Matt, what you're describing, you're a member of the Army, the Army National Guard. You could be federalized and then become part of the United States Army. If you were captured, you would be afforded POW status. And what I'm advocating is... I don't believe that waterboarding should be conducted on prisoners of war. But these people that are being these terrorists, remember, they're terrorists. They're not prisoners of war. So the Geneva Convention does not apply to them. They're not fighting fair. So your situation is completely different because you would be afforded prisoner of war status. If you were to go into another country and strap and stick a dynamite on your back, then honestly, I believe you should be waterboarded. But your situation is completely different.
So basically you're saying terrorists are criminals and criminals should have less protection. Where do you draw the line? Do the local – I live in Niskayuna. Does the town of Niskayuna police then get to torture somebody because they think that he might have information about burglaries?
I don't believe that they are criminals. I think that's the wrong word to use. I think terrorists are animals. I think that – you know, we should be able to use whatever needs we need to use to get that information from.
Okay, but as a lawyer, you can't call somebody an animal. They're either enemy combatants, they're terrorists, or they're POWs. You said they're enemy combatants. That's the same as being a criminal.
The court has ruled that they are – well, the court has basically ruled that they have to be afforded the same protected status as POWs.
Okay, yes. So the town of Niskayuna can't waterboard people for burglaries.
Absolutely not.
So why does the military get to do that to, you know, international criminals?
Well, I think that we're talking here about national security issues where we're dealing with protection of thousands of civilians. I mean, town of Niskayuna, we're talking about, you know, a burglary or...
Well, what's the basis of waterboarding? You know, for example, what do they have to be accused of? Can the people waterboard anybody, or does there have to be some type of factual basis to support waterboarding?
Well, I don't know the answer to that because I've never been privy to that type of information as to what is the standard before they waterboard someone. I would imagine it's got to be a high-value detainee or a high-value captured person that they're going to do this. They're not waterboarding every person that is detained during military operations.
It's How do we know that, though? I understand under military operations, you know, my division captured thousands of Iraqis. But, you know, the people that went to Gitmo were the cream of the terroristic crop. How do we know that not everybody at Gitmo was waterboarded?
I guess the answer to that is we don't. A lot of them do claim that they have been tortured while at Guantanamo Bay.
Doesn't that change your position then? If an innocent person was waterboarded, that's unfair. Obviously, if they're a terrorist,
they wouldn't be sent to Guantanamo Bay, correct? If they were innocent, truly innocent.
Well, you're innocent until proven guilty, correct?
I think in war, that's debatable.
But I think we have to also remember here that this is not war. A lot of these people that are being held at Guantanamo Bay are terrorists. This is during a terrorist action. These are not people that were swept up during armed conflict between two nations. I think there's a big distinction here.
You know what scares me is that back during World War II, the American population was very keen to imprison Japanese. And now we're apologizing to all the innocent Japanese that we did lock up. I just hope that in 30 years from now or 50 years from now, we're not apologizing to all these people that we locked up.
I absolutely disagree. I think that's a completely different – I think what happened with the detainees during World War II was horrendous and you know, very wrong. But what we did here is we're picking up people that we have pretty good cause to know that they were picked up on the battlefield and that they you know, potentially were terrorists. Is there a problem with holding them for 8 years without due process? I think yes. I think that they should have been afforded due process. I think that's where the problem lies. But I don't think we're ever going to be apologizing to these people.
Well, you know, I'm still caught up before we went to commercial break. We were talking about deserters, and I'm still caught up on this. If there's still a lot of debate about what we're doing in Gitmo and whether or not it's lawful, can I use any of that in a defense if I wanted to not go to Iraq or not go to Gitmo?
No. We're actually seeing the level of desertions climb in the Army, in the Navy, in the Air Force since the Iraqi war. And absolutely, you cannot say that the reason you're not going to serve is because it's an unjust war.
When you say desertion, what do you mean? Like they just get up, pack their bags, and leave?
Well, I mean, desertion is a military crime, and it really needs to be broken down into two parts. You have AWOL, which is absent without leave. Basically, what that means is you're not at your place of duty where you're supposed to be, and it's usually a period of time that's less than 30 days. Desertion is a more serious crime because you form the intent to actually remain away from the Army forever. Usually we use the benchmark of 30 days, but it could be less. If you pack up and you sell all of your military uniforms and you take a bus ticket to, you know, to return home and you have no intention of coming back, you're a deserter at that point.
Well, Greg, you do a lot of court-martial criminal defense. One of the other things that I know comes across your desk a lot is missing a movement. How does that apply to desertion and AWOL?
Well, missing a movement is a lot more serious of a crime because you're basically being ordered to perform a specific military duty, or you're being ordered to deploy somewhere, and you're basically missing that movement. And what I mean, if you miss a movement, the potential penalty is going to be a lot higher. We're seeing that more. We're seeing guys that are coming down on orders, and they're basically just not showing up where they're supposed to be. And the commands are taking a much stricter view of that, and we're seeing soldiers now doing jail time at military confinement facilities.
You know, just for the record here, wherever my country orders me to go, I'd go. But if I didn't want to go to Gitmo, could I get charged with AWOL, desertion, and missing a movement?
Well, there is something called multiplicious and duplicious charges in the military, and what that means is you can't be charged multiple ways for the same thing. You'd be charged for probably desertion and missing a movement, but you couldn't be charged for also being absent without leave. Time for another short break, though. When we come back, we'll keep looking at the military court system.
Usually, a mortgage company's sole focus is property, but first-rate funding is centered on people, not property. Whether you're buying a home or struggling with your current adjustable-rate mortgage, first-rate funding will give you the same amazing personal service. First-rate funding, New Corner Road, Albany, and Broadway, Saratoga Springs. Don't wait. Call today, 452-4700, and please go online, firstratefunding.net, and see how they can help you today. Registered mortgage broker, New York State Banking Department. Mortgage loans arranged with third-party providers.
As a busy working professional, looking good's important to you. No one understands this better than Best Cleaners, the Capital Region's premier garment care provider and dry cleaner. Got a wrinkle in your schedule? Best Cleaners offers pickup and delivery of your dry cleaning right from your home or office, so you don't have to fit one more errand into your busy week. Call 458-BEST, and we'll take care of the rest. With three locations in Del Mar, Loudonville, and on the Latham Circle, Best Cleaners. Always look your best. Call 458-BEST. 458-BEST.
If a commercial lease is in your future, listen closely. Conley Associates will provide you with an honest, unbiased comparison of available office space. Unlike the competition, Conley Associates works directly with you, the tenant, finding your business the ideal location at the best terms. Best of all, leave the landlords to us, because we represent tenants only. Secure your new office space with a tenants-only approach from Conley Associates. Landlords need not apply. Conley Associates, 463-5500.
You know this isn't the right job for you, but the problem is you don't know what the right job is. If you're looking for career advice, Careers in Transition LLC can help. Careers in Transition LLC is a career counseling firm that helps you figure out the right job for you. They're not an employment agency, and Dr. Tom Denham is not a headhunter, but they can help you write a better resume, prep for a job interview, and a lot more. Careers in Transition LLC, 11 Computer Drive West in Albany, 366-8451, and online, careersintransitionllc.com.
We are back to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Greg Rinke, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Tully, and on-air correspondents, Val and Chris. Find out more about us at www.tullyrinkeshow.com. We're back with our look at the military court system. Before we broke, we were discussing desertion and AWOL. And what I wanted to discuss a little bit was how is the military justice system different than the civilian justice system? And there are pretty big differences. When you're in the military, you are subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And if you are charged with a crime, basically we don't have grand juries in the military, but we have something called Article 32 hearings. And Article 32 hearings are basically like a civilian grand jury where you would have to be indicted, but in a military system, you would, or a summary court, a Article 32 officer would basically make a recommendation to the convening authority.
What's the convening authority?
A convening authority would usually be the post commander or the commanding general of the post.
So while a grand jury comprises 22 people, generally give or take a handful, Article 32 hearing officer is just a company or a field grade officer. So it's one person in the military versus 22 in the civilian world.
That's right. But there's a lot more protections afforded to the military member in an Article 32. The Article 32 member has the right to be present, has the right to have defense counsel present, has the right to question and call witnesses during an Article 32. During a grand jury hearing, during the civilian side of things, there's no rights to call witnesses and to cross-examine. And so there are more limited rights actually under a grand jury proceeding. And everyone knows the saying, you can indict a ham sandwich before a grand jury. So actually, I do feel that the Article 32 is more protective than the grand jury proceedings in the civilian world.
Now, I've heard comments of, you know, anybody can get hit with a court-martial. But aren't there various levels of court-martial?
There are. Bottom line court-martial would be a summary court-martial. Maximum penalty there would be 30 days confinement. You don't even go before a judge. You go before a summary court-martial officer, which is usually a company commander, a captain.
What type of a crime would have to be for that? What would you have to do?
Usually an AWOL, maybe a low-level barracks thief stealing from someone else. An assault, a bar brawl would probably go before a summary court-martial. The next level highest court-martial would be a special court-martial, A special court martial can adjudge 1 year of confinement and adjudge a bad conduct discharge. And then the highest level court martial you have is a general court martial. A general court martial can give the death penalty in the military and can also adjudge a dishonorable discharge.
Does a general court martial mean that it's convened by a general? Is that why it's called a general court martial?
That is the reason that it was called a general court martial. Historically, it was convened by a general officer. There are certain provisions where it can be convened by a colonel. But it's got to be a very serious crime to go before a general court-martial. Usually we're looking at a rape case, a murder case, or some serious larceny.
And general court-martial is the only type of court-martial where there's actually, for lack of a better term, a jury?
No, there is the right to and we call it a panel in the military. We don't call it a jury. There's a right to a panel at a special court-martial as well. The panel, though, at a special court-martial would be lesser. There would be six individuals on the panel as compared to more individuals on a general court-martial.
You know, one thing that most of our listeners probably aren't aware of is that a court-martial doesn't have to have a unanimous decision.
That's absolutely right. And that, I believe, is one of the weaknesses of the military justice system is that it is you can be convicted by a two-thirds vote of the panel. The only case that has to be unanimous is if it's a death penalty case.
Yeah, and what's the rationale behind that? Why didn't they follow the civilian standard of unanimous juries?
I think it was a compromise because originally court-martials were convened by the commanding officer. Basically, the commanding officer would mete out punishment under the American Army system dating back to the Revolution, and I think it was a compromise that we want to give more protections to our soldiers, but we don't want to make it so hard to conduct discipline in the military that it has to be a unanimous jury. I think it's something that's going to be revisited, and potentially that is one of the changes that has been recommended for the military justice system is to go to unanimous juries.
And court-martials also afford people certain protections, or I guess I should say the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, provides special protections such as Miranda warnings, correct?
That's right. We call it Article 31 warnings, which is very similar to Miranda warnings. And actually, it's more protective in the military than it is in the civilian world. In the military, if you're even accused of a crime and your commanding officer or military law enforcement come in to question you, you have to be read your Article 31 rights, which basically say you have a right to remain silent. You don't have to make a statement. You have a right to military defense counsel. The civilian side of things, there's no right to be read your Miranda rights until you're in custody. So the military side is more protective in regard to that.
Now, to get back to this desertion and AWOL issue, I know I'm harping on it tonight, but I notice across your desk you're getting an increased volume in AWOLs and deserters that are looking to retain private counsel. Don't you, when you're in the military, have free counsel afforded to you?
You do. There is something called trial defense service, and you have the absolute right to have military defense counsel appointed to you. And interestingly enough, when you're in the military, you actually have the right to request a specific military defense counsel, and if he's available, he will be made available to you. The problem, though, with these AWOL and deserters is they're not on a military post. Most of them desert. They go home, and they go to their girlfriends, and they're not near a military base. So the ability to speak with a military defense lawyer is probably going to be reduced. So that I think that's the reason that we're seeing more and more of them seeking out civilian defense counsel. And also I think a lot of them believe that civilian defense counsels are going to be more aggressive. They have more time to spend on each case than military defense counsel.
Well, I know that you have Sam Wright, who's a retired Navy captain working for you. He was a judge advocate general in the Navy. I know you also have Phil Cave, who is a former military judge working for you. Why would somebody retain a private attorney at whatever your hourly rate is to handle this when they get free attorneys from the military?
Well, I think absolutely it comes down to trust. I think a lot of people have problems when they know that the prosecutor is wearing a military uniform, and then they walk into their defense attorney and they see the defense attorney is wearing a military uniform, and it's not that uncommon to see prosecutors and defense attorneys doing physical training together in the morning, maybe having a beer at night, and going to lunch together at the chow hall. So I think that there are some problems with that.
That's like that Tom Cruise movie back in the
90s. Few Good Men, exactly. Yeah. I think the Army JAG Corps and all the JAG Corps branches are very small, and it is a very close, tight-knit family where you might be a prosecutor You know, one day and defense counsel the next. I think another reason a lot of people do hire civilian counsel is experience. The average trial defense lawyer probably has 2 to 3 years of experience. And I've heard horror stories of people coming directly out of the JAG school and being assigned as a trial defense lawyer. And that would scare the heck out of me if I was accused of a crime and I was that attorney's first client. So I think that's another reason why more and more people that are charged with military crimes are seeking out civilian counsel, because we have more experience, we dealt with the military system, and also there's not that fear that we have to deal with the system because we're no longer part of that system. I don't care if I'm going to piss off a commander.
One of the things I find also interesting with the court-martial system is that certain offenses that are not punishable as a civilian are punishable in the military. You know, technically New York has an adultery law, but it's not been enforced recently. But in the military, adultery is a pretty common offense.
Absolutely. It's a common offense that is charged. However, normally adultery is not charged alone. It's charged with something else. Adultery is normally charged with rape. It's charged with a sexual assault. Where it is charged alone, usually it doesn't rise to the level of a court-martial. Usually it's disposed of by what we call non-judicial punishment, which would be in Article 15, where a commander can take rank and some pay. The reasoning, the military system is different. Should adultery be prosecuted in New York? Probably not, because there's not the same reasoning as there is for adultery to be prosecuted in the military. And the reasoning is in the military, you're in a unit. And if one member of your unit is sleeping with your wife, when you deploy with that other service member, there's going to be some problems with good order and discipline. You know, you're going to go to combat with this person. This guy might be, you know, your battle buddy in your foxhole with you, defending, you know, each other. And, you know, if you know in the back of your head that he was having an affair with your wife, there's going to be some issues with good order and discipline. And that's the rationale for the prohibition on adultery and why the military still takes it very harsh. Another situation that happens quite a bit is you have a soldier who's deployed, his wife is back home, and you have another soldier sleeping with her. You know, what does that do to the morale of the soldier who's deployed to Iraq for 15 months to get a letter, you know, basically, you know, I'm dumping you and I'm hooking up with Sergeant Jones? So that's one of the reasons that this is very frowned upon in the military, and it is prosecuted still.
You know, another thing that I find interesting is fraternization. When I first joined the Army, I could date enlisted soldiers in other branches of the military. I could even date other soldiers as long as they weren't in my chain of command, if I remember correctly. But that rule changed a few years ago. So now as an officer, I can't date any enlisted person in any branch of the military. It doesn't seem that there's a rational basis for that. If I wanted to date, you know, somebody in the Navy and I'm in the Army, I should be able to do that. Why, under the UCMJ, can I not do that?
Honestly, I don't understand why that rule was changed. I think the rule was changed in early 1999 or 2000, because I was actually in the military when that rule was changed, and I remember it shrinking my dating pool quite a bit. So honestly, I don't agree with the rule. I think that the reason it happened was there was a lot of officers sleeping with enlisted soldiers. Sometimes you do have the feeling that the enlisted soldier might have to sleep with the officer. And I think that's the reason why, from a position of power, you know, an officer might outrank an enlisted soldier, and there might have been a feeling that they were pressured into having to sleep with the officer.
If I wanted to fight the constitutionality of that, let's assume I was convicted of fraternization, what's the appeal process? If I'm convicted of court-martial, am I done?
Well, no. You have the right to appeal to the convening authority, and then the next course of action would be to appeal to the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, and then next you can appeal all the way up to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, and in limited circumstances you can appeal to the Supreme Court. And that's another case where I think that is an interesting issue, which we might have to explore in another show because we're almost out of time today. But military members do not have automatic rights to appeal to the Supreme Court.
So if I had a military defense attorney and I lost at a court-martial, I should probably think about hiring a civilian attorney.
Absolutely. I think you'd want to hire a civilian attorney that would be able to go through the record and see what mistakes were made. That's it for us this Sunday. If you have more to say, check out our website at www.tullyrinkyshow.com. You can send us an email anytime at info@tullyrinkyshow.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be here on WGY each Sunday at 9 p.m. Be sure to join us next week.